from high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're here. Brian Kilmeade Show. Big, big week. Another Senate race has come in. Just as expected, we projected Dave McCormick wins Pennsylvania. Not out of it yet. The Republicans aren't out of it yet with Sam Brown over in Nevada. And believe it or not, Kerry Lake is within 1 point in Arizona. Sadly, it does not look like Mike Rogers is going to win in Michigan. I guess they declared it for Slotkin. So that's so disappointing because he is just so qualified. I thought he ran a great race on the ground, in the air, everything. We'll find out about that. Hopefully, Donald Trump puts him into his cabinet in some way. This hour, we're going to be joined by Tom Carrico, senior fellow with the International Security Program, missile defense expert, because the president-elect has talked about building up an Iron Dome for this country. Is it feasible? We'll look at that. So before we get to Senator Shelley Moore Capito, let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
As California Attorney General, if Trump attacks your rights, I'll be there.
You come for my people, you come through me.
If you try to harm New Yorkers or roll back their rights, I will fight you every step of the way.
Hey, read the room, kids. Let the resistance begin. Foolishly, self-serving governors and AGs misread everything about the election, announce their plans to Trump-proof their states. I have news for you. The best thing you could do is just do your job well. Days of living off Trump's fame are over.
Number two.
It was a red wedding style defeat. It was a catastrophe. We cannot just call Americans racist and bigots and say that that is the reason why Kamala Harris lost.
As Linda Lee, a senior Harris surrogate, the political earthquake still shaking the nation as Republicans try and lock up the House after increasing their majority in the Senate. We look at the gains and the reason why Trump's agenda resonated with America and the Dems didn't.
Number one.
He had really good people working with him the first time, and he's got really good people working on it now, and that when he focuses in on it, as I imagine he's starting to do, you know, we're going to start getting those decisions, and I'm going to be working with them one way or the other.
Trump wins, names his first staffer, and his historic selection as well, but not unexpected. We, Susie Wiles, and we look at the leading contenders and the big three names who have been removing themselves from contention, not because they don't like Trump, it's because they just want to stay in their current posts. Senator Shelley Moore Capito joins us now. She was on Appropriations and Transportation. We don't know what she's going to be now. She now is going to be joined by Jim Justice. The Republican won Joe Manchin's seat in the Senate. Senator Capito, why did this version of Donald Trump not only win going away with over 300 electoral votes, but also the popular vote by between 5 and 7 million? What changed? Do we hear her? Yeah, it looks like she just dropped off. Well, I'll tell you what's changed. I think the country saw 4 years of Joe Biden that wanted the opposite, number one. Number two is you had a very aloof vice president who had no idea that she had to actually tell how she feels and why she feels that way. She didn't want to sit down at all with anyone. And the people that knew her in the Senate said there's not much there. And we're not talking about intellect. We're talking about the ability to understand issues and have an opinion on them and take action with them. Now Senator Capito joins us. Senator, why such a decisive win in 2024 when it wasn't there the previous two times?
Well, good morning, and sorry about that. I had myself on mute, and I didn't realize it.
No problem.
I think it boils down to something so incredibly simple that the Harris folks kept denying and trying to convince the American people that this wasn't occurring. It's the mom, it's the dad going to the grocery store and seeing the cost of food and how their hard-earned money can no longer stretch to help their family. I mean, they kept saying, no, the economy's great, everything's fine, inflation's going down. People are not that stupid. They understand when they're stretched, and then they see the illegal immigration issues. I think those are the two main big issues. The Biden administration and the Harris administration had 3.5 years to prevent 10 million people from coming in, and instead they went the opposite direction and welcomed them in. I just think those issues were so resoundingly critical to Trump's election and his numbers, because his whole plan, which he laid out a concrete plan, and that helped too, but his whole plan is to change both of those things very dramatically. And I congratulate him on sticking to the message and also for the ability to really read the room so, so well.
Right. So Trump gains even in the places where he lost. 12 points in New York, 11 points in New Jersey, over in Massachusetts, 9 points. He also gained over in California. Texas, he won up 8 points. He won dominantly. In Florida, for those people who think Texas is slipping away from Republicans, not quite. And Florida, over 10 points. So among Latino voters between 2020 and 2024, he's gone up 6 points. He's now at 41%. And if you guys as a party can understand the formula, that could be the turnaround that grabs the Hispanic vote, maybe for the conceivable future. But if people want to know what's wrong, I always, after a major loss, after Obama won in 2008, I always look to see, you know, what's going to be the reboot before everyone gets into their political corners and worries about reelection. David Axelrod laid it out, and the numbers back him up. Listen to this, cut 18.
You can't approach working people like missionaries and say, we're here to help you become more like us. There's an kind of unspoken disdain, unintended disdain in that. I think Biden has done, you know, programmatically some good things for working people, but the party itself has increasingly become a smarty pants, suburban, college-educated party, and it lends itself to the kind of backlash that we've seen.
And right, by the way, the only place they increased was people who make over $100,000. That's where Harris improved. What kind of candidate do you think she was?
Well, you know, I actually was she was so much better, I thought, than 2020. But I just thought, you know, she's dragging in Hollywood stars. You know, people can't relate to that. They're flying in their private jets. They're talking about how it's terrible that we need to tax the millionaires and billionaires, which is them. And you know, the hypocriticalness of it just rings hollow, I think, with regular people. So I wonder who were in those crowds. Was it the people that David Axelrod was talking about, just more of an elite group, or was it somebody who's coming because they think they're going to see, you know, a Beyonce concert? I mean, I just think that their whole message was, as he said, very condescending. And I said earlier, the American people are not stupid. They know when things are good, and they know when things are not as good, and they are not as good as they were under Trump, and people know it. And so, you know, I read an article, I think it was David Brooks at the New York Times, and you know he can go one way or the other, but he wrote this article about the respect gap, and I think that is absolutely true. She and her supporters and her rhetoric and even President Biden, others don't respect working people, and they know it. And so I think they just she didn't go on any media. She didn't have any spontaneity to her. She never gave specificity of plans. She kept trying to worry about who she's going to offend. At the end of the day, people want decisive leaders that they know are going to make their lives better. And she did not make the case.
So a couple of Democrats, and I'll weigh in and we'll move on and talk about what the agenda
sure.
is. But anonymous House member said this from the Democratic side to Axios. Democrats just literally attacked everything he did, meaning Trump. He would never agree with anything, never give him credit for anything, could never say, well, actually securing the border is a good idea. I just disagree with how he's doing it. Tom Suozzi said this, a Democrat from Long Island who won George Santos' seat. Instead of saying, how can people vote for Donald Trump? We should have been asking, why do people vote for Donald Trump? What did he do right? And what did we do wrong? I mean, that's why he won, because that's kind of a red area. But I assume he kind of believes it, because in Nassau County, they were actually shooting off fireworks when Trump won. So isn't that a logical question to ask?
Absolutely. And I think, I mean, when, you know, I do a lot of work in the environment and public works space. I am set up to be the chair of that committee, actually, which I'm very excited about. all the policies that came through were so woke. They're preventing projects from being constructed, preventing pipelines from being made, preventing energy from being sourced in our own country. All of it was about who are you and what is your history, rather than we know who you are, we know you want an opportunity, and yeah, energy provides you that opportunity. And that's what the policies have been over the last 4 years. And again, people just said enough is enough.
So talking to Senator Capito of West Virginia, Senator, you have a new partner. What is Governor Jim Justice going to be like as Senator Jim Justice?
Well, I was down at the Greenbrier with him for his victory party, and
he gave a
great speech. And yes, which he owns. So, you know, not too hard a lift for me or him. I talked to him yesterday. He's excited, and I think we'll work very well together. And he has obviously a great energy background, but he has the heartbeat of the people. He appeals to the same sort of common sense working people that Donald Trump does. And so I think I'm excited about him coming, and I look forward to working with him. I think we've known each other, small state. We've known each other a long, long time. And so I think our partnership will be very good.
He's looking to run for the Republican Policy Committee.
To
run for.
Yeah.
So what would that entail?
Yeah. Well, thanks for asking about that. We're going to have leadership elections, and obviously who's going to replace Mitch McConnell is the big question. But there are six leadership slots. I'm number five right now. I'm moving up hopefully to move to the policy committee. What I will do there is help my members and their staffs formulate a unified message on policy. And certainly with President Trump being at the helm, we're going to be working closely with the White House here. So let's just say you have a transportation or environment issue or a military issue, I'll have the staff to be able to prepare our senator staffers so that they can prepare their senator for the pros and cons or what direction we think Republicans will be going in concert with the House. So it's an inside working with a lot with the members, but it's also formulating very policy oriented. And I also will run the caucus meetings that we have once a week, which is where all of our voices are heard.
So
I'm excited about it. I don't have an opponent so far, so it's the way to go.
So everyone's talking about who's going to replace Mitch McConnell. Mm-hmm. Some people say it's Cornyn. Some people say it's Thune. Senator Rick Scott wants in on that. Steve Daines turned it down. He just said he doesn't want to go back and forth, and he spent too much time in Washington. But he did such a great job getting 53 Senate seats at least this time around. Who are you supporting?
Well, it won't surprise you. I'm not going to say who I'm supporting because I'm friends with everybody, all three of them, and they all have strengths that are I think, really complementary. And so we'll see when they present their cases to us on Wednesday morning. We're talking to them all on the phone. Everybody's calling everybody. I know it's going to be a good leader, and it's going to be somebody that's going to be able to work with the president. That's very important. But more important is probably how they work with the 52 or three other senators, Republican senators, to have that unified voice so we can beat back the challenges that we know we're going to have.
It's an exciting time, Senator Capito. And the thing is, it's going to be – now you have the majority, you got pressure, but you also have a president – that only wants 4 years, not even thinking about reelection. Just make the 4 years productive. And I think it could be great. People say lame duck. I don't think so at all. I think it's free.
I don't either.
I think it's free.
I think if I could say anything, and I don't think President Trump would ever not be this, but I think it gives an opportunity to be even bolder. And we're going to have all three or two houses and the executive. We need to seize this moment. Very exciting.
Real quick, I'm over time, but do you think being that he did so well and brought the Senate and held the House, it looks like, and he is such a dominant win, do you think Democrats might be looking to cooperate more than they have in the past?
I think the overwhelmingness of the numbers definitely help him. So, I tend to be an optimist. So there's many things, problems that we have, things we need to solve. Let's hope for the good of the country we can all come together. I think it's possible. We'll wait and see how the rhetoric formulates. So far, the Democrats have been rather conciliatory. Congratulations. You won. Let's do the best for the country. So let's keep that attitude.
All right. There you go.
All right.
Senator Capito, thanks so much. Have a great day.
You too. Thank you.
All right. And she has a partner now in Jim Justice. We'll have him on, too, hopefully next week. Bottom of the hour, missile defense for the country. Is it possible? You'll find out. Next, your calls, 1-866-408-7669. We have Susie Wiles is in as chief of staff. Who should be next and why? Don't move.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade. From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Stay on top of the latest news and information from Fox News. Listen and download the Fox News Hourly Update on your time. The trending stories you need anytime you want it. Listen and download now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com. A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
The people pulling the strings of the Democratic Party, get rid of them. They've lost the plot. Tonight is on the Democrats. It was a ringing endorsement to the Republicans, Trump, ringing indictment against the Democrats. They got to look themselves in the mirror. This moral superiority complex they have, this arrogance they have, it's not working. It's time to wake up and see that.
Yeah, that is Dave Portnoy of the Barstool, not really partisan, but it was just so obvious to so many people, especially when Trump was out there doing the podcast, getting to know him, you know, whether it's Andrew Schultz or whether it's Joe Rogan or the Nelk brothers or the Nelk boys, excuse me. You got to know him and you go, you know what? I know where he stands for. I know why he's saying the things he says. And after 3 hours, you don't need Jake Tapper to interpret or Wolf Blitzer to interpret what he means and how irrational he is because they don't believe that anymore. Here's what David Axelrod said to Dave Portnoy's assessment.
I absolutely think that that's what it is. I don't know if I put it just that way, but I think that he's on point there. I think we owe people the respect for what they do and what they mean. You know, when all these blue collar workers and people who do things with their hands in their back, they make this country go, and they feel like they are thought of as less and that their priorities are not the priorities of the Democratic Party.
And so that's an Axelrod. But here's why the outgoing Jamie Harrison, what a failure he is. He does not even own up to the facts. The election's over. Said Biden was the most pro-worker president of my lifetime. Saved union pensions, created millions of good-paying jobs, and even marched in a picket lines. And some of MVP plans could have fundamentally transformed the quality of life and closed the racial wealth gap for working people across the country, from the child credits, $25,000, to a down payment for a house, to Medicare. He wasn't the most pro-worker. And just picking up a sign and walking around with 9 other people one day, I don't know. Let the union has a side and management has a side. If you go too pro-union, the product suffers because they got to get their balance sheets out. So you either make less cars or you hire less people. That's why presidents don't usually get involved in these things. They might get involved by bringing mediators in. I don't think that's a good thing. And also, the number one car manufacturing state is Michigan. Why did Donald Trump win it? Because he said that EVs should be an option that should not be mandatory. The dealership shouldn't be forced to sell them. And people shouldn't be given incentives to buy them with big time tax credits, because a lot, it takes less people to build. Okay, that's fine. That's called improvement. But a lot of the rare earth has to go outside the country to a place like China. How is that in our national security, and how is that not more expensive? And what do we do with the batteries? He never answered that question. That affects Michigan. That affects Wisconsin. That certainly affects Pennsylvania. When we come back, can we defend our country with a missile defense? The entire country, like Iron Dome. We'll discuss it.
A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
They have to restore deterrence. And that has to start with military capability, certainly. The last 4 years, the budgets have been flat. No increase. China is outpacing us. You name the platform, and they outpace us in it dramatically, except for submarines. The Air Force and the Army are too small. The Navy doesn't have enough ships. The defense industrial base needs to be replenished. It takes money to do it. When we play war games, publicly recorded, we run out of offensive missiles in a war game against China in 2 weeks. I mean, that's the reality of the erosion of the military capability that has taken place in this country.
General Jack Keane with me an hour ago on Fox and Friends, talking about what Trump has to do, and that is to establish deterrence, begin to spend. And also, he went on to say, you have to reform the spending practices of the Pentagon. They are too slow. They're not quick to adjust. And too many people are dug in to make profit. Tom Carrico joins us now, senior fellow at the International Security Program, director of the Missile Defense Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Tom, do you agree with what General Keane said that you hope that Trump does?
Yeah, I think I agree with just about all that. I think the fact that DOD's budget has been flat or arguably declining in terms of relative to inflation, that's not a good thing, certainly in terms of relative terms to China. I think also the reference to deterrence has been a good one. Look, there's some B-52s parked in the Middle East right now. There's some aircraft carrier groups parked in the Middle East right now to tell Iran, hey, why don't you stop this nonsense of shooting at Israel, for instance. But it's been slow to sink in. But I think writ large, there's not just a new administration, but there's a new Congress coming in here. And this is fundamentally an opportunity to tear up the FRA, Fiscal Responsibility Act, as it applies to DOD. And I've got two words for you. Roger Wicker, if he comes in as the head of Senate Appropriations for defense, I think that's going to be a very good possibility for
supervised the total evaluation of Pentagon spending. What are some of the conclusions he came up with?
Well, number one, and it was alluded to just a minute ago, is we need more ships and submarines. We also need a lot more missiles and munitions writ large. And, at this point, the Ukraine conflict is now a combined arms effort between China, North Korea, Iran, and Russia. And it's going to be important to degrade things and win there to get them to stop hemorrhaging. And one of the things that have been so important there is air defenses, air and missile defenses. That's going to be in massive demand for deterring, as well as if we have to prosecuting a conflict elsewhere in the world, whether it be in Europe, whether it be in the Indo-Pacific or anywhere else.
So, Tom, the president talked about an iron dome for the country. Can you get missile defense for a country this size?
I think that is a metaphor. It's a metaphor for the need to have some kind of active air and missile defenses. It's not about defending every cow pasture in Texas against everything that can come in. But there are big gaps and big holes, especially in terms of, well, frankly, the sort of things that we see in Ukraine on a weekly basis, the cruise missiles. That's not a theoretical problem. That is a very practical problem. And so cruise missile defense, ballistic missile defense, yes, hypersonic defense, these are all going to be important to deter a conflict with China so that they don't wake up and say, hey, we think we can pull this off.
Right. I mean, they now are sucking wind economically. They're trying to print all this money and put it into the system. It is just not going. And they're 20% unemployment. We watched a submarine just sink the other day, a nuclear submarine just sink a month ago. So they're not a juggernaut. They have money willing to spend, and they're aggressive. But the combining North Korea, Iran, Russia, and China has got to be concerning, especially when they put 10,000 troops, the North Koreans, in with the Russians to fight the Ukrainians.
Yeah, and I think about that troop transfer, not just in terms of filling a gap or sending people into a meat grinder, but rather as experience for their officer corps. So they're going to be learning things and taking those lessons back. And so I think there's a layer of cooperation here that's more than just sending stuff or sending munitions or sending bodies. There's a layer of learning and intelligence gathering that is being shared across the board here.
So, Tom, when you look at the missile defense, you know that there's tremendous demand from Israel, tremendous demand from Ukraine. And now, are you concerned that Iran is going to try to get it from Russia? And do they have it available?
Well, the Israelis, to their credit, just took out a number of the Iranian air and missile defenses, their S-300s and that sort of stuff, leaving them pretty defenseless. So it turns out that our strike capabilities, the Israelis' strike capabilities to suppress air defenses are pretty good. So the Iranian missile defenses, not exactly at the top of my worry list, because, again, the Israelis just took them out. But we have a different posture. We have a more defensive posture in the world, and that's why It's important for the United States and for its allies, Japan, Australia, all these folks, to have those things, because we're not going to be the ones taking an aggressive action against our adversaries.
So do you think you said that the Pentagon needs to be reformed? Will there be pushback from that? Are there people who are unwilling to change there? And are they, is that a situation where, with the right defense secretary, with the right vision that you mentioned, they can go in and fire people or move them out if they're not going to change?
So, you know, I think it fundamentally starts with leadership. The Pentagon, like other bureaucracies, have all the tools at their disposal to do things fast if they want to and when they want to. It's about prioritization. Prioritization comes from the top, and it comes from vision, and both from the executive branch, but also, as I said before, Congress. So, you know, whether it was, you know, MRAPs, armored vehicles in Iraq back in the day, we moved heaven and earth to build as many of those as possible in a rapid period of time. And so it fundamentally is about prioritization and vision. Yes, there's always bureaucracy and process, but those apparatuses can be bent in the proper context. And will be.
I hope so. Here's what Jack Keane said about that. Cut 38.
We have to fix the Pentagon's ossified business practices. It's risk averse. It's too slow to get a platform. It takes years. You look at the commercial sector and how quickly they can turn a platform. It's remarkable compared to the three or four times it takes to the Pentagon to get a system. And the other thing is it's too costly. And we've got to bring in modern commercial business practices into the Pentagon with innovation and certainly technology.
So that would certainly help. We got to get the R&D together with the Pentagon and act quickly. Aren't we learning a lesson from Ukraine, what they're doing with drones in real time? Now they're making their own, how they adjusted some of the equipment that we have gotten. Some of our defense missiles have been used as offensive missiles.
Yeah, I think there's a number of things here in terms of how we think about the business of defense. You know, you mentioned earlier the profit incentive. I don't want to be relying upon companies to be supplying the Department of Defense at the lowest profit margins possible. I want people going into defense because they think they can make money.
Yeah, sure.
And that there's an alignment between doing the right thing for the United States of America and defense. And so the commercial motive, you know, people invest in Apple because they think there's going to be a return on investments. And if there is one asymmetric advantage that the United States has, it's our private capital markets, our private wealth. So we want to leverage those things as opposed to just the taxpayer dollar. We want to leverage all of that strength and wealth to protect and to invest in ultimately our national security. So I want to bend a little bit there that we want to leverage that. We want to leverage the profit incentive, and we do need to change the business of defense and the contracting of defense as opposed to merely demonizing it.
Right. So how does the president say he's going to solve that problem in Ukraine in 24 hours? How does he even approach it?
Well, I think the important thing is going to be providing Ukraine with the best negotiating position. And it's always good to negotiate from a position of strength. I think allowing, changing the policy to allow the Iranians to shoot back, to go after the supply depots, even if they be in Russia, even if they be with Western supplied munitions, that's perfectly reasonable, perfectly acceptable. We've got to stop asking the Ukrainians to fight with one hand behind their back, because we don't want this to continue on forever. We want them to win. We want them to get to a position where they can at least negotiate from position of strength.
Yeah, that would help. When it comes to Hamas, they are now asking for a ceasefire to end this conflict after the election of Trump. This is an opportunity to get hostages back because they know it's going to get a lot worse for them, because President Trump, if you look at his profile, he will give Netanyahu a lot more room than Biden, and he's not cutting off weapons.
Yes, but I would also say that Hamas, if they are indeed asking to negotiate, after it's because of the posture and of the way in which the Israelis have prosecuted the Hamas conflict and also the Hezbollah conflict. They've been going after their leadership. They've been putting the pain between the ears of the decision makers. And so that goes a long way to changing the minds of the decision makers. And so I think, again, having that overall posture to not sitting and taking it, but rather to taking the fight to them. That there's lessons there for the Ukraine conflict as well.
Tom Carrico with us. And Tom, before I let you go, I mean, this is somebody that hasn't fought in wars, but sometimes in life, you need an opportunity to maybe cool things down. You think it's maybe you have an off ramp. Do you think on some level, with Russia losing 500,000 people, with the Palestinians losing almost all the Hamas fighters and sadly some civilians, Hezbollah losing their entire top brass, do you think that they might say, okay, with Trump coming in, or if we put it out there to go out immediately, there might be an appetite to scale back? China's economy doing so badly, wondering about, you know, what's going on with, you know, buying the Iranian oil, which is about to end. Do you think there might be any search for an off-ramp from the new Axis powers?
Look, I think if there is going to be that off-ramp, it's not going to be by letting the foot off the gas. It's by convincing them that the Israelis, the Ukrainians, and the United States will lean forward and that they will lose. And that's the best way to get them to stop, is to convince them that they will lose and it will not be worth the cost
right.
to continue.
So and I think save face, too, just, right? Save face. That matters.
Yes. And so they understand hard power. It's not going to just be about the force of personality or the threat of personality. It's also going to be hard power and continuing the tempo.
Yeah, I don't want the Russians to think they've won. I'm a rarity. I want the Ukrainians to be successful, and that should be a priority. And I hope that gets back. I hope the president comes around to that point of view. Tom, thanks so much.
All right. Have a good one.
All right. Back in a moment. Listen, when I come back, I'll be going out to Ohio, going out to Virginia, going out to Glendora, California, and New Mexico. I want to find out what you have to say about this Titanic election change, this big movement. It looks like the House will be retained with a small margin, by the way, and the Senate, 53 seats for Republicans. And a Republican with over 300 electoral votes and no Russia phony scandal to stop him. We're in a little bit of a honeymoon now. How would you like to see the president execute during this time? Who would you like to see him hire? How do you think that, what role can he play in these 3 weeks or 4 or 5 weeks before he takes power? You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Coming to you on a need-to-know basis, because, man, do you need to know. It's Brian Kilmeade. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
We are in the midst of a meltdown, and if the party is just going to vilify anyone who has the courage to stand up and say what needs to change, we are going to keep losing. If we don't recognize that America has finally shifted to the right, that we're undergoing a rightward shift, we're going to keep losing. We cannot keep indulging the fringe of the party at the expense of the American people.
See, the only thing I criticize her for, that's Linda Lee, DNC's national finance chair. She's a Harris surrogate, or used to be. No one will be a surrogate now. Is that it's not America going to the right. It's American using common sense. These aren't even conservative things. Enforce the border? That's not conservative. Don't put girls in men's sports. Or don't put men in girls' sports. That's not conservative. Enforce crime is not conservative. I'm not talking about crack down on crime. Enforce crime. Don't defund the cops. Respect them. Use all the above when it comes to energy. Scott in New Mexico. Hey, Scott.
Hey. Hello.
Hey, what's on your mind?
So what's on my mind is that I'm very glad that Trump got elected, so he would have a chance to put America first, MAGA people, instead of Mike Pompeo as the defense secretary. And hopefully all the warmongers, and also work with Congress to cut off the $200 billion grift to Ukraine that only cost us manufacturing jobs. We can invest that money here in America domestically, and we should negotiate a good faith ceasefire with Vladimir Putin. I'm pretty sure that it would be much better than spending and wasting all our tax money.
Scott, I hear you, but just having a ceasefire, giving up maybe a third of your country for an invasion that was unwarranted, it's just flat out theft. while you kid, they kidnap children, bring them back and put them up for adoption in Russia. I think that if you just said, okay, let's get a ceasefire without getting the kids back, getting them most of that land back, paying for the infrastructure, there's got to be, that means they'll be rewarded for this brutal invasion. So I understand wanting to get it done and people say we got to spend it home. I think you could do both. I think you got to get, there's a victory plan that the Ukrainian president has. I'd like to take a look at that. Gil in Florida. Hey, Gil.
Good morning, sir, and thank you for taking my call. I would like to ask you to please educate me what Mr. Gavin Newsom is referring to as the freedoms they would like to protect against Donald Trump.
Freedom to get an abortion, I guess? Freedom to transition your kids without telling your parents? Or if the kid wants to be known, if Robbie wants to be known as Roberta, not telling the parents. I mean, this is the stuff they care about.
Freedom to do drugs?
Yeah. Open-air drugs. Open-air drugs.
Freedom to steal $950 yep. at Walmart, Target, CVS?
Yes, that's what he wants. That's what he wants. And by the way, there was criminal justice passed, Proposition 36, so there's going to be a bit of a crackdown. I don't know if that $900 threshold has been rescinded. We will see. But I think I'm going to play this clip for you. I saw it last night with Adam Smith. When asked about the new resistance moment cropping up in Gavin Newsom's quest to be a counter to Trump's White House, I want you to hear what he said. Cut 33.
Look, there's a lot of different factors here. But, you know, I will say bluntly, I think our party needs to do a better job of standing up against some of the extreme left policies that have really propelled Donald Trump forward. And, you know, I'd give the same advice to Gavin Newsom that I'm going to give to our new governor, Bob Ferguson, here in the state of Washington. If you want to stand up to Trump, I suggest you don't ever mention him. I suggest you govern well.
You know what it's called? Don't worry about it. Just do your job and people will notice. Do your job. Be efficient and people notice. Senator Murphy said the same thing as Governor Pritzker, as Gavin Newsom and Governor Hochul. They didn't call you out. He didn't go after your job. In fact, he, as the most part, Donald Trump profiles as a president that likes to give power to the states. Who are you fighting?
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here. Michael Schellenberger in studio, founder and chairman of Politics, Censorship, and Free Speech at the University of Austin. But he's got a lot of jobs. And Neil Chatterjee is going to be with us shortly, too, at the bottom of the hour, former chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission under President Trump. First thing Trump wants to do is the border. 1B is energy. He wants to maximize it responsibly. And you're going to see it really pick up, especially if we believe Iran's the issue. You take Iran's energy off the market, it could spike oil. Not if we pick up the pace a little and others do the same thing, like Saudi Arabia, who was the first person to call Trump after his monstrous win. So I come to you from Midtown Manhattan and a rare visit from Michael Schellenberger here. Michael, great to see you in person. It's the first time I'm seeing you in person.
It is really nice to see you in person, Brian.
Did 3 hours with Joe Rogan. I enjoyed every minute of it. You got your wide swath. You just spent time in Brazil.
Brazil is a warning to all of us. It's a sign of what could have happened here. I mean, they actually are preventing their popular former president, Bolsonaro, from being able to run for president again. Of course, that's what they're trying to do with Trump. They're doing mass censorship. I mean, you know, Elon Musk was in a tough situation. It was, you know, deprive 22 million Brazilians of X or agree to government demands to ban about 300 people. They had to make a tough choice on it, but we're still fighting down there. The Brazilian people, you know, at the end of the day, we're all Americans. We're all in the Americas, and they really love their freedom there. And so we're absolutely not giving up, and we're going to keep fighting.
And what people don't understand is Joe Biden loves Lula. Lula is basically mentored by Castro. Yeah. This guy is a corrupt guy that should be in prison. He got out. They propped him up. They put him back in. And Bolsonaro gets railroaded out, and he was a Trump guy. And because he was pro-Trump and very similar to Trump, all of a sudden, the Democrats don't like him. But it's, and Joe Rogan didn't know either. They don't understand who the good guy was.
Well, it's a crazy story because, as you may know, I was on the left. I was on the radical left. I interviewed Lula 30 years ago this year, and I asked him. I was actually always in favor of free speech, so I wasn't that way. But I said, "Are you going to turn Brazil into Cuba and restrict free speech and have censorship?" And he said, "Absolutely not." He promised me that 30 years ago. I wrote an article about it back then. And when he started censoring earlier this year, I called him out on X about it. The Brazilians are – but they're in the streets. We had hundreds of thousands of people in the streets of Sao Paulo, Brazil in early September.
Are you rallying them?
No, I'm just – I mean, I'm just – you know, I'm just sort of a like a little American mascot. But I'm happy to sort of be there. And we did the Twitter files, Brazil, which showed mass censorship demands. It was awful. I mean, it's not just that they were doing censorship of individual content. They were literally banning people – from every social media platform, which is basically destroys the lives of independent journalists and independent politicians. You have to be on social media to be in media or politics. And so it was a kind of totalitarianism down there that really gives us a glimpse into the future that we want to avoid.
And it just backs up, and I know you agree with this, is that Elon Musk buying Twitter, out of all the things he's contributed to society, from our space program to the electric car to the chips in the brain. Buying Twitter, taking a huge loss to get it, probably is his greatest contribution to straightening out America. Because what you discovered there and what you found out, you had our intelligence agencies along with the government on the outside restricting and shadow banning some of the most important voices in America, whether it's Don Jr., Don Sr., or the laptop information.
Look, our intelligence community is in a very bad way. We are 50 years into we had big reforms in the mid-70s. So we're in a very similar moment. We had the Church Committee and the Senate. That's when we discovered the CIA was engaged in assassinations, mind control, drugging people. Crazy stuff was uncovered. We cleaned out the intelligence agencies. They're back to being politicized, weaponized, corrupted. J.D. Vance yesterday, or I think it was yesterday, said that they are going to take action on this. We need new heads of the FBI, CIA, and Department of Homeland Security. But more than that, they got to put in place real reforms to protect our freedoms. They've got to put a check on these warrantless wiretaps that they're engaged in. We saw with the Hunter Biden laptop, and I think people have a sense of it, December 2019, the FBI knew that that was a legitimate laptop. In 2020, the FBI, because they're spying on Rudy Giuliani, they knew that he was giving that the laptop that he had to the New York Post. They ran a disinformation effort. It's so sinister. The FBI and the CIA ran a disinformation effort to convince the social media companies and the journalists that the laptop wasn't real, that it was Russian disinformation. It's such a stain on
those agencies. So what they said ahead of time, just to refresh everyone's memory, is there's going to be something coming your way.
That's right.
And it's going to be look like it's going to be authentic, but it's really the Russians putting phony information out. And when it happened, Zuckerberg told Joe Rogan, yeah, we got a heads up that this thing was going to happen. And when the laptop came out, we said this is exactly what they warned us about. And we were in on suppressing it.
It's shocking.
Just so you know, 15% of the electorate said they might have voted differently had they known that Joe Biden and his family were involved in these overseas business dealings that could compromise their ability to lead clearly and without constraints. That matters. Why does it matter so much that Trump not get elected?
Oh, I mean, you mean 2020?
Probably now, if you had their – like, why were they so desperate to get him out, and why were they so desperate not to let him in?
You know,
and keep them there.
I mean, I asked a bunch of people this question, including people that revealed to us that the CIA had manipulated the intelligence assessment that came out in early 2016, claiming that the Russians favored Trump. The evidence actually showed that the Russians favored Hillary because she was continuity. The Russians thought that Trump was too much chaos and, you know, too much madman, wild man. They didn't know it was unpredictable. So they manipulated the intelligence assessment. I mean, that is a serious high crime by the CIA, the CIA director at the time, James Brennan. Why did they do it? You know, I asked people, is it because they were worried that Trump was going to normalize relations with Russia? Were they worried that they wouldn't be able to go to war and be warmongers? I think there's some of that, but I just think these guys hated Trump. They just hated him at a visceral level. And I mean the heads of the intelligence agencies. They were dogmatic Democrats. It was Trump derangement syndrome at bottom.
Can I also say, and I don't know if you guys said that on the show, but Gina Haspel was the head of the CIA.
Yes.
She had to sign off on that, okay, the 51 intel agencies said the laptop was real. She looked at it and said, go ahead, you can put that letter out there. So is Gina Haspel also anti-Trump?
Yes.
Who Trump put in that spot?
100%. Gina Haspel was part of the disinformation operation. You have to remember that the politicization of the intelligence agencies is so radical. And throughout American history, what you want from your CIA and FBI directors to be scrupulously nonpartisan, did not engage politics. She approved that letter from those 51 former intelligence agents within hours. All she had to do, right, assuming she didn't already know, was pick up the phone and call the FBI and ask them if the laptop was real. She did not do that. She is absolutely a traitor to not just the Trump administration, but to the American people and to the Constitution. She violated her oaths of office. Right. These are serious high crimes. They need to be investigated.
So we're here with Michael Schellenberg. Michael, you know the West Coast. You moved out to Austin, but you've lived there for how long?
30 years.
30 years. Where?
Berkeley, which is across the bay.
Don't you feel we're a self-correcting country?
Yes.
And if you think I'm too optimistic, fine. But guess who's out? You lost to Chesa Boudin because terrible performance. You just lost the mayor, London Breed, just lost an election. Now you have they lost their AG over in Los Angeles. What's his name again? This terrible.
Gascon's out.
Gascon is out.
So Bachman is in.
And Donald Trump added 6 points in his popularity in California. Are they beginning to wake up in a place that Ronald Reagan used to be governor?
It's a revolution. I mean, I don't know what else. I mean, you're right to be optimistic, and I'm thrilled. I literally haven't been this happy in years. In fact, the day after the election, I was like, what is this feeling I'm having? And it was like a feeling both of happiness but also relief.
You're not a Republican.
Not a Republican. I'm an independent. I was, like I said, I was on the very radical left. I wasn't just like a moderate Democrat either. They drove us all out of the party. I mean, look, you have 75% of voters in San Francisco that want to arrest people that are camping publicly, smoking fentanyl in public, and get them the care they need, to get them into rehab. Where they're reviving people 10 or 20 times from fentanyl overdoses before they then die. This is insanity. I mean, I discovered a 2-year-old child on the streets of Skid Row, surrounded by people that are violent, psychotic, holding weapons. It's an extremely immoral situation. It's actually even better, though, than you said.
Prop 36.
Prop 36 is the main event. I mean, that recriminalized drug dealing. It recriminalized shoplifting under $950. So, yes, you have to crack down on fentanyl. This is the most dangerous drug. Beautiful medicine for people that are going through back surgery, like my mother. Smoking fentanyl and meth on the street is a death sentence. They also recalled, Brent, they also recalled the mayor of Oakland because she's corrupt. She's under FBI investigation, classic, for garbage contract corruption. They recalled the attorney, they recalled the district attorney of Oakland as well as the district attorney of Los Angeles, both George Soros-backed district attorneys. Gavin Newsom is now, they're in a narcissistic bubble. Their egos are so fragile that they can't acknowledge defeat. But what they ended up doing was driving all of us that had some concerns, you know, around what's happening on the streets. They drove us all out of the party.
Right.
So you've got this reaction now that I think is absolutely healthy. It gives me hope in the American people. It gives me hope in the people of California.
But also, all of a sudden, you're Gavin. Gavin Newsom comes out, and he's going to be part of the resistance. He promises to Trump-proof California. He's having an emergency meeting. Pritzker, something similar. Governor Murphy of New Jersey, something similar. We're going to Trump-proof. Governor Hochul, a press conference yesterday with that lunatic Letitia James. How does Gavin Newsom Trump-proof California? What is he talking about? It's about freedom. What kind of freedom? What is he talking about with freedom?
Well, I mean, who is he to talk about freedom? Last year, we reported that he created a snitch line, literally taxpayer-funded snitch line for people to report so-called hate speech, cyberbullying. Somebody was mean to me on the internet. I'm going to report them to the government. He created that. We are engaged in an immoral medical mistreatment experiment against children, adolescents, and vulnerable adults. California is the epicenter of it. It has to stop. 70-80% of Americans are against the so-called gender-affirming care. There are two sexes. They cannot be changed. There's been no scientific breakthrough that allowed you to change sex. They're doing drugs and they're blocking puberty. Puberty is a human right. Everybody has the right to go through puberty.
Believe you just said. Do you realize what you just said?
It's right. Crazy, I mean, that you have to say that.
Yeah.
You know, right. It is a pseudoscientific cult. The idea that you could change somebody's sex, you can't do it. These children, and also it's mentally ill adults, are being abused. I mean, this is the worst medical mistreatment scandal since lobotomies, thalidomide, it will go down in history as an absolute stain on California, on Gavin Newsom. Gavin is trying to prevent schools from informing parents when their children have been brainwashed into thinking that they're the opposite sex. So for me, when I look at the priorities of the incoming Trump administration, we have to do something to end this barbaric practice.
Even if he was a pure political hack, he would have to look at the flow charts, look at the pie charts and say, yeah, this is not going to get me elected. I got to change. I got to go to the middle. I got to change my opinions. Like so many of these politicians in New York did, the ones that flipped the seats back to Democrat had Trump in their ads. So they weren't running way to the left. I have a great idea. Let's put men in women's sports. They denied it. They ran from it. So you would think Gavin Newsom, if he's just a political animal, would say what Michael Schellenberger just said. Hey, you know what? I can't do this gender affirming care. I got to come out and crack down on crime and take credit for Prop 36 and hopefully have short term memory loss. But he's not. And I don't get it. You believe he's just in a bubble. I'll talk to Michael more about that in a second. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. On the historic week, this is one of the biggest surprise elections that I can remember in many ways. Not so much that Trump won, but how he did it and who he brought with him and what it means for the direction of the country. Don't move.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
We got a real chance to make real change. This is like one of the first times ever where there's a real chance to make real tangible change that's going to be for the good of everybody. Yeah, and he's got to unite people. He's got to not attack the left, not attack everybody. Let them all talk their but unite. Now it's time to unite everybody.
So that was Joe Rogan yesterday after doing the endorsement the Monday before the Tuesday election. Mike Schellenberger, a good friend of his, is here just fresh off his show. There's hope in his voice. He never wanted to get political. But you were saying to me when you walked in, his endorsement had such ripple effects, even surprised you.
Oh, it did. I mean, I was surprised by how much the media now. I mean, even the Axios co-editor today was like, look, we just have to admit that Joe Rogan is bigger than all of the mainstream media at this point. I mean, Joe's also expressing something else, which I was saying, which is like we just felt a sense of relief and catharsis. I mean, including those of us that were on the left. I mean, it was getting really totalitarian around here. You know, there was a lot of persecution of heretics and dissidents on the left, and it drove many of us out. Tulsi Gabbard, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Joe Rogan, Elon Musk, minor figures like myself that got just kind of beat up and were like, this is not the party that we were used to. It's kind of taken over by – there's a derangement that took it over.
You know what's interesting is somebody who's different as Donald Trump is, he wasn't asking for you to believe in some existential project that never worked before. He's going, let's enforce the border. Let's build up our strength. Let's not get involved in wars. Let's start using our natural resources and maximizing it. Nothing I just said is radical. Unfortunately, we weren't doing any of it. And they were denying that they weren't. Were you shocked at what they were saying about the border at the end? Oh, it's enforced. It's fine. It's down. It's never been a problem. And now it is a problem. Then it wasn't a problem. But we all knew it was a problem.
Well, it's the gaslighting. I mean, they call it, you know, the psychologists call it gaslighting because it's basically, you know, what abusive, husbands do to their wives. They beat them up and they say, oh, I didn't hit you, honey. No, that we were basically being abused and persecuted for the last decade by a woke totalitarian mob, and then after people complained about it, they denied that they'd done anything wrong. I think on the other issue, Brian, is just that civilization is not that complicated. You need to have border enforcement, law and order, meritocracy, cheap energy, equal justice under the law. We're in a back to basics moment. The kids need to get back to reading. They need to get back to learning their math. We got to have a proper way for people to come into the country. It's not, like you said, it's not rocket science. This is not landing a rocket. This is just doing some of the basics.
And that's why you're at the University of Austin, right?
I'm very happy to be. You know, it's exciting timing. We got a new university now in Austin. It's an incredible opportunity. Got some
What's
really bright
about
kids.
It?
What's different about it, first of all, is it's founded on the principle of free speech. I mean, that is fundamental. Is that
Barry
free
Weiss,
expression?
Neil Ferguson.
That's right. You know, Pano Canelos. It came from the great books. He was running St. John's, a great books program. It's a real commitment to Western civilization. I mean, I think we forget how rare free speech and democracy are in the long history of humanity. It's just a very tiny, brief moment. I mean, 250 years, we're going to celebrate the 250 year anniversary in this country in a couple of years. I think it's a chance to feel some gratitude for what, you know, people that died for free speech.
Right.
I mean, people died for our democracy. We should have that same level of commitment.
What do you hope a degree from University of Austin does for people when they look at resumes, when they see University of Austin? What do you hope a prospective CEO looks and sees?
They're going to see a whole human being, an authentic human being, somebody who has not been made a one-dimensional person with one-dimensional views, that can see some of the complexity of the world, that doesn't see it all as good versus evil, that if they disagree with their fellow Americans, they want to understand where they're coming from. I certainly want to teach something that we had learned in high school debate, which is that you better know how to represent your opponent's argument better than they are able to represent
it. If you want to win it.
That's the heart of it.
Right, and that's good. And you're going to teach in January.
I'm going to start in January.
First time?
It's my first time teaching ever. Yeah, amazing.
Well, but you certainly have the resume. I'm sure the kids are going to be signing up. Michael Schellenberger, exciting time. Thanks so much for the quality time on this historic week.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
All right, back in a moment.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
He talked about having a sovereign, secure border. That, as you said, not just energy independence, but energy dominance, being the energy market for planet Earth. About ending wars and restoring peace and stability all over the planet. He talked about revolutionizing science and technology, sending an American astronaut to Mars, working with Elon Musk to lead the way into space.
That is Stephen Miller talking about he's going to be a key advisor to President Trump, and he was talking about what they're doing with energy. I know they talk about the border first, and it will be, and deporting the criminals, and they'll do that. But right in 1B is energy. Neil Chatterjee joins us now, former chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission under Trump and former senior advisor to Mitch McConnell. Neil, there's a lot of anticipation of what and a lot of anxiety to some, but anticipation about finally reaching our potential with energy exploration. What is feasible for this administration to do right off the bat?
I mean, I think hour one, just taking office, will provide clarity and certainty around certain energy resources like gas. I think one of the big frustrations of the past 4 years is the Biden administration really struggled to figure out what their view was towards gas. On the one hand, they looked at things like U.S. liquefied natural gas exports as a savior to Europe and giving our allies an alternative to piped in Russian gas. And then they simultaneously issued a pause on certificates for these very needed LNG export facilities to get that gas to Europe. And that kind of confusing signal, confusing messages really caused a lot of turmoil. And so I think just providing that clarity and certainty simply by virtue of taking office will not just day one, hour one, lead to, you know, kind of, you know, a stronger investment environment so that we can make sure we have this infrastructure going forward to do it cleaner, better, right, and more economically sound than anybody else.
So, Neil, here's the maddening thing. You say you want to crack down on Russia. You want to hit them with sanctions. You're going to take them off the SWIFT banking system. And you're going to tell Europe, you better not buy oil and gas from them. And we have the natural gas, but we want them to not buy it from Russia. But we stopped and we froze new leases on natural gas. Not only not hurts it in Europe, it hurts Japan, who are counting on us. How does that make a coherent foreign policy?
The craziest thing about this, you know, I look at these facilities and I think, all right, here you've got projects that create economic growth and job development here at home that have geopolitical value in making the U.S. a real player on the international stage, and clean U.S. LNG displacing dirtier sources of energy overseas. You mentioned Southeast Asia, Japan, China. U.S. LNG displacing their dirtier fuel actually helps the environment as well. It is a win-win-win. It confounded me that the Biden administration didn't understand that. And I think on day one, hour one, the Trump administration is going to reclaim that win-win-win for America.
And I know that places like Pennsylvania, they'll do it. There'll be other places that'll have resistance to doing it within our country. But could you explain to people listening how you could say, I don't want to ban fracking, but at the same time, you could ban it by slow approval of leases, by making it a financially too much of a risk for banks to get involved in, and just making federal land, expanding the amount of federal land you can't drill on.
And permitting. You know, there are so many permits required for these facilities.
Yeah, that's a better word. I meant to say permitting instead of leasing.
Yeah. And so you can basically tell folks, well, no, I'm not going to ban fracking. But then you pursue a bunch of policies that make it, you know, economically challenging to move forward with these facilities. And that is a backdoor way to do it. You know, the Trump administration is going to reverse course on all that day one. And I think Americans are going to see the benefits. Now, some damage has already been done, because when it comes to these natural gas export contracts, they're long-term contracts. And a lot of off-takers overseas who wanted to work with the U.S. to buy our gas, they've been slow to close these deals because they were worried that there wasn't certainty about what the future of gas policy would be in the U.S. I think right off the bat, even before the election, in the next 75 days, you're going to start to see re-engagement from some of these off-takers, because they will have restored confidence that under a Trump-Vance administration, that the U.S. will firmly remain behind gas.
Are you going back?
We'll see. I haven't been asked. You know, if I were asked, I would certainly consider it, but I haven't been asked. It's not my call, but we'll see what happens.
So, Neil, a lot of people look at this and say, okay, Trump's in, regulations will drop, but there's going to be pushback up from the bureaucracy against this. Environmentalists who have been planted inside these organizations, is it very hard to dislodge them and stop them from gumming up the works?
Look, I mean, you know, there's going to be a big push on this. You know, the president rolled out this policy called Schedule F that, you know, kind of makes it easier to handle personnel matters in these bureaucracies, in these agencies. Look, I will say, I worked at a mid-sized federal agency, was the chairman of it. There are a lot of wonderful public servants who are you know, making sacrifices to serve their country. I'd say the overwhelming majority are. But you do have some bad actors here who try and pursue their own agendas and not the agendas of that, you know, that are in the public's best interest. And so, yeah, I think there will be some pressure from the Trump administration. They're much more prepared coming in this time than they were back in 2016.
I hope so.
Ideas.
And they understand Trump. That's the main thing. Don't agree. You know, doesn't mean you have to agree with him, but you have to respect him and understand that his rule, his word matters. Debate yours, put your side in, and then let your defense rest and do it. Unlike some other people, they were probably really good people that just couldn't handle it. Tillerson, Mattis, Kelly, and others. So, Neil, explain to me what Iran's oil on the market has meant. There's a sense that right before the election, the last thing they want is gas prices to go up. So even though Iran was rocketing Israel twice, fomenting terror throughout the region, supporting the Houthi rebels who have shut down the Red Sea, we did not want to stop them and look the other way when they were circumventing the sanctions, selling to China and others, because we're afraid of the spike of oil prices and gas prices. Could we, number one, was that, do they have enough of a footprint in the global market to affect the price at the gas station in America?
You know, I'm not a total expert in that sphere. There are others that could probably speak more intelligently to the impact of Iranian oil supplies. I will say what I am looking forward to is that while, yes, U.S. oil production has continued to prosper and has been at record levels, but it still doesn't mean that we're fully taking advantage of it, because of the mixed signals, because of the fear of future regulations, because of the fear of future crackdowns. So removing that uncertainty is going to enable the U.S. to impact global oil markets. And that's what I'm encouraged by. But I'm not enough of an expert on the Iranian situation, unfortunately.
Should we be buying Venezuelan oil?
Absolutely not. I mean, absolutely not. Why would we, when we have the ability to be energy, not just dependent, but independent, but energy dominant here at home?
Thank you. I got to ask you about something really concerning people not getting enough attention because of the election this week. So the Nashville power grid was almost blown up by a suspect who was looking to blow it up with a drone. Skyler Filippi, who appeared in court, court documents wearing a skull mask and showing off homemade bombs. So they foiled the attempt in Tennessee. Do you know anything more about this?
I don't know the specifics, but like things like this have been happening the last couple of years. You know, and I think there's been a lot of focus on what folks' motivations are. But from my standpoint, when I was in the government at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, my foremost responsibility was oversight of the reliability of the grid. Because when the power goes out, it's hugely disruptive to American life. And various actors have come to realize that. And, you know, sometimes the motives range from, you know, teenagers horsing around, people who had too much to drink and think it's funny, or folks with genuinely nefarious motives. And so this is just something that we all collectively have to be vigilant about. We have 54,000 substations in the United States of America. The most critical ones are required to have kind of 24/7 surveillance and protection, but it is just too costly and too untenable to have that level of surveillance and protection around every one of these 54,000 substations. So we've just got to make sure we remain vigilant.
Really? There's nothing together. You could do to make them a harder target? Have you seen plans in place to do it that would be cost effective?
There's pros and cons, right? So in certain regions of the country, you could put sandbags over transformers that could propel a bullet. But then if it gets really, really hot, the impact of those sandbags could be more detrimental than even a bullet. Replacing chain-linked fences with, you know, hard fences seems really practical. But then when you start to look at the cost implications across 54,000 substations, that starts to get pretty expensive pretty quickly. Having video cameras there can help you maybe catch someone after the fact, but isn't necessarily a deterrent if someone's determined to do something beforehand. I think, you know, law enforcement, intelligence services, as indicated by this current situation, have done a pretty good job of cracking down. But the reality is that cyber and physical threats to the grid are just something that those of us in the energy space are now going to have to get accustomed to deal with. Here's one thing that the Trump administration can do, again, day one, to really help here. Speed up the clearance process for folks in the energy industry to get security clearances. I once had the CEO of a pipeline company, major pipeline company, come and tell me he got briefed by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence that his system was vulnerable, but he didn't have a single person in his entire company that had a high enough clearance to get the TSSCI level briefing to even know where to invest to protect his system. Because this is new to those of us in the energy space, this idea that we are now kind of at the front lines of you know, these kinds of attacks on the grid. And so we've got to get people clearances. There are other things that we can do to coordinate across the state and federal level with industry to make sure that we stay ahead of these threats.
What about nuclear? That's, they say, the problem is becoming efficient, but they got to protect it because the nuclear energy could be a weapon, correct?
Yeah, so look, that's one of the challenges with nuclear power. We're even talking about advanced reactors, smaller, you know, reactors, small modular reactors. At the end of the day, even a small reactor is, you know, it's a nuclear facility that needs to be guarded by an army 24/7, and that, you know, can be a cost deterrent to the deployment of nuclear power, just the security fact of what it takes to protect it. Sometimes that pushes away investment in nuclear.
Yeah, I just wonder what Europe's going to do because they're shutting them down, right? Are they still shutting nuclear or are they reopening?
So we're about to see – I don't think folks around the world have fully wrapped their brains around how much the demand for power is getting ready to surge, driven by data centers, driven by AI, driven by the need to power data centers to support AI. There is an AI race that is going to take place around the world right now. China is building a nuclear plant a week to try and win that AI race. We need more power here in the U.S. And I think our European allies, in the manner in which they've handled their resource mix, they're going to find themselves falling behind in that AI race because they're not going to have the power necessary to meet all this coming, you know, surge in demand.
All right, Neil, get your resume back in there. I'm sure they know what you did. And hopefully the energy sector is going to be really exciting with this administration. Hope you're back in.
I know the president listens to you, so put a good word in for me.
You got it. Of course. Hey, I'm his number one advisor. Neil, thank you. When we come back, we'll be able to take some of your calls. Brian Kilmeade Show in this historic week. Don't move.
Learning something new every day on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
And I will work with him or anybody, regardless of party, on these kind of efforts that I know will benefit the state of New York. However, if you try to harm New Yorkers or roll back their rights, I will fight you every step of the way. New Yorkers are resilient. We fought the first time around and we'll fight again.
So this idiot, Governor Kathy Hochul, total fraud. Instead of saying, well, America has spoken, we were able to flip three seats back, Democratic seats back, Democratic on Long Island and New York City. And, you know, we lost a lower seat, a Mondaire, whatever. And by the way, we see Donald Trump, a New Yorker, became president of the United States, and we're still New York, and we wish him the best. Like the mayor said, Mayor Adams said, congratulations to governor, to the president and president and vice president-elect. She shows no class. 2 days ago, she comes out, and then Letitia James follows. Cut 30.
And if possible, we will work with his administration. But we will not compromise our values or our integrity or our principles. And we are prepared to fight back once again. Because as the Attorney General of this great state, it is my job to protect and defend the rights of New Yorkers and the rule of law.
Really? She's already getting huge blowback, and you're going to hear from it, including somebody that might just be the next Attorney General, who basically said, we're not messing around this time. We will put your fat ass in prison for conspiracy against the rights. I promise you that. That from Mike Davis, a direct quote. I dare you to try to continue your lawfare against President Trump in his second term. Listen here, sweetheart, he says. We are not messing around. Wow. That'll get him the job. Jerry in Connecticut. Hey, Jerry.
Hey, I was calling about, I live in Connecticut, but I work in New York, and I got this unhinged letter from State Senator Liz Krueger, 28th District. And why it's significant is because Trump Tower, among other places, and I think Fox News, and possibly even ABC, they're in her district. So in a sense, this is not a college professor. You know, this is not that kid screaming on the sidewalk 8 years ago, however long ago it was. This should be, I mean, she's quite elderly. This should be a responsible individual. But, I mean, she must have not heard a word Joe Biden said, because, let's see, the letter begins with, there is no question our nation is entering a dangerous and uncertain time. And then she has another, she quotes an author about people kept faith in the dictatorships of South America in the 1970s and 1980s.
What's her name? What's her name, Jerry?
Her name is State Senator Liz Krueger, K-R-U-E-G-E-R. And what I'm calling about is perhaps either somebody could send, my first thought was to call the Secret Service. Before she seems to be inciting an insurrection with her words. My second thought is to call the NYPD and have somebody do a wellness check on her.
Yeah, a lot of people need it, including every late night host, not name Greg Gutfeld. I'm serious. I mean, everyone, the late night shows, everybody on MSNBC, they're just nuts.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Thanks for being here, everybody. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. Historic week, a fun week. Zvika Klein is going to be with us at the bottom of the hour, editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post. Man, you want to get the pulse of the people in the ultimate hotspot in the country, in the world? In the country, what am I thinking? In the world where Donald Trump's going to be like a laser focused and probably is already on top of it because of Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran, Houthi rebels, the elements in Syria and beyond. We'll talk about that. And by the way, Iran continues to say we're looking to assassinate President Trump. Is that okay with you? And if you think that President Trump's not going to back off with his Iran policy, Brian Hook is being asked back to help out as an advisor to Iran. He is also on the hit list from the Grand Ayatollah for taking out Soleimani. He is part of the brass knuckles against Iran, who is the problem in the region. Before we get to Shannon Bream, let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
As California Attorney General, if Trump attacks your rights, I'll be there.
You come for my people, you come through me.
If you try to harm New Yorkers or roll back their rights, I will fight you every step of the way.
What losers? These guys from Illinois and California and New York. I'm going to stand up for my people for what? Let the resistance begin. Foolishly self-serving governors, AGs, misread the room and announce they have plans to fight back on Trump and make their state Trump-proof. From what, may I ask, we'll discuss.
Number two.
It was a red wedding style defeat. It was a catastrophe. We cannot just call Americans racists and bigots and say that that is the reason why Kamala Harris lost.
Okay, I'm pretty sure there's a lot other reasons why. The political earthquake still shaking the nation. As Republicans try and lock up the House after increasing their majority in the Senate and flipping it, we look at the gains and the reasons why Trump's agenda resonated with America, and the Dems don't have a resume.
Number one.
He had really good people working with him the first time, and he's got really good people working on it now, and when he focuses in on it, as I imagine he's starting to do, you know, we're going to start getting those decisions, and I'm going to be working with them one way or the other.
There you go. That is Marco Rubio. I think he's going to be the next Secretary of State. Trump wins, names his first staffer, and his historic selection. It is a strong woman. It is Susie Wiles. We're going to look back at the leading contenders and the three big names that have removed themselves from contention. And Shannon Bream, I should say four, because you've removed yourself too, right? When asked, you will not serve.
Correct. I am busy with other things, and I think I need to focus there.
Well, you have to have a better answer than that if he asks. I'm busy
oh,
with
gosh.
Other things.
All right,
it's
I'll
the
work
President
on it because I
States.
Expect to call at any time.
Right. I'm sorry. I'm doing something else.
I'm
it's
covering
not good.
Your administration, not being in it.
Oh, that's true.
That's what I do.
You could one or the other. They pay equally. Actually, they don't. That's the point. So, Shannon.
Well, I mean, the benefits package here versus the White House, I don't know. Fox Benefits is pretty good.
Now, Susie.
I like my dentist. I don't want to have to change that.
Right. That's the only reason why
that's
you won't
my answer.
Leave.
I don't want to change my dentist.
Don't
want to
change
the job.
Right. And if we could get you the same dental plan, it might be a go.
I mean, I got to have some negotiating leverage, so okay. We'll see what you can do.
So, Shannon, I know Fox News Sunday. Don't tell us yet who's going to be
okay.
on. But I do want to ask you about Susie Wiles being named as a strong woman, the chief of staff. Not the biggest surprise. I thought the main reason was I thought she wanted to go back to Jacksonville. I did not know that she wanted to do this because it's exhausting doing what she did for the last 2 years.
Exactly. And I think all of us, when Susie's name was floated, weren't sure she would actually want to take it. It seems like a very smart choice for President Trump because she's, you know, kind of known as the one that's like a Trump whisperer, that she really can talk strategy, calm him, calm some of his impulses, and works really well with him, and he trusts her. So that's the kind of person you do need as White House Chief of Staff. It's a different job than running a campaign, which is excruciating, it's exhausting, it's all those things. But Washington is a different beast. And remember when he won in 2016, I don't really think they were prepared to win and do this transition and walk in. He knows what he's doing this time and who he wants surrounding him and how this is going to work. So she seems like the right skill set and match for him.
So what is the more intriguing for you, filling up the cabinet for President-elect Trump or the destruction of the Democratic Party? You have, I couldn't believe this video, and they have a lip reader. There's a video of Nancy Pelosi sitting there on the I lost concession speech, Kamala Harris, and she's approached by Donna Brazile, who seems to be yelling at her. And then you have the mayor Bowser say, ladies, calm down, calm down, calm down, because it looks like Donna Brazile blames Nancy Pelosi for everything, could be anything, for getting rid of Biden, for not kicking him out earlier. What are you hearing, Shannon?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of consternation, and the finger pointing is going in every direction. But as you know, it is Biden and Harris, those two teams going at each other. There are those very frustrated that Biden was encouraged to run again and that there wasn't more of a voice saying, hey, this may not be the best idea for us. And then there are those that say, you know, Harris didn't run the right campaign, that she didn't connect with people, she didn't give us enough information about, you know, people were left to think that she was very progressive based on things that she's done and the ways that she voted on things in the past, and that she didn't have enough time to make her case. And then, of course, you know, there are Democrats who are just saying, hey, listen, the American electorate is misinformed. There's disinformation out there. They're sexist. They're racist. And a lot of Democrats feel like, listen, we can't stop there. It's very shallow. That's not going to get us to the lessons we should take from this Tuesday shellacking. So plenty of blame game going on here in D.C.
I want you to hear Linda Lee. She's the DNC National Finance Chair. Cut 11.
It was a red wedding style defeat. It was a catastrophe. This wasn't a squeaker. It wasn't a margin. It wasn't a margin of error race. She resoundingly lost. And we really have to be introspective and realize that we cannot just call Americans racist and bigots and say that that is the reason why Kamala Harris lost. There are other reasons that we can go into, but you can't just vilify the entire country. It doesn't work like that. And so that's not conducive to a productive conversation. And you're going to keep losing if you alienate the voters.
Right. And this is the time. Soon they're going to get into their own and get ready for the midterms. This is the time where people are being honest. Mm-hmm. And saying what went wrong. And the thing is, yeah, if they went through a primary process and she emerged, she would have had to have been four times the candidate she is right now. Shannon, I think it's safe to say she's a terrible candidate, never felt comfortable in unscripted situations, never had a press conference in 107 days, never used the 3.5 years to do anything significant or look ever sure in front of the camera. I'll give you an example. Well, J.D. Vance, in a short period of time, he did 3-hour podcasts. You have other podcasts he did before. He was able to overcome calling Donald Trump as an evil person, a Hitler-type person. This guy's handling 4 Sunday shows a day. And yours was too easy for him, I think, because you were a normal person. And you let him finish his questions. So go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely was out there doing the stuff, taking the questions. And even when the vice president would go to friendly places like The View, she got in trouble there. That was the big question when she was asked what would she do differently than Biden, and she couldn't come up with a single thing. I mean, that was supposed to be a rah-rah, let's bolster her, this is going to be an easy interview, it will make her likable. And it ended up being one of her worst moments on the campaign trail. So, you know, it's a strategy to not go to the difficult interviews. I mean, she finally sat down with Brett, and I think people got to look at the fact that it was hard to get to policy details with her in that interview. So, it is different when you compare it to a J.D. Vance who almost never said no to an interview. And if he did, it was because he was sick or exhausted or something was going on. But he was willing to show up in all kinds of places and have difficult conversations where, you know, it seemed Democrats vacillated back and forth. Is it better for her to do sort of the, you know, basement campaign, stay away from details? Oh, no, now let's get her and Tim Walz out there everywhere. Is it too late? They should have had tougher practice interviews before this. It just seems like, listen, it's tough to mount a presidential campaign in 106 or 107 days, but those are the cards you're dealt. And, you know, critics of the vice president within the party and without just felt like she didn't rise to the occasion.
Is there a sense by your show Sunday we'll know roughly the balance of power in the House?
Remember last time it was December. I mean, some of these things that even if we get a count, there are automatic recounts. It depends on state law. So we don't know. I think we'll definitely be closer. There will be a couple more races. We probably get called before Sunday. I don't think we're going to be all the way there, but that's one of the deep dives we're going to do on the remaining races and how they're looking.
Who are you thinking about booking? A lot of times you still don't have everything solidified yet. What are you thinking?
Yep. Well, we've got Congressman Dean Phillips, who is one of the few people to step up and say, I don't think President Biden should run again. And he actually ran against him and picked up some delegates in the primaries, but never really got traction. I mean, I'm sure he's feeling vindicated, not happy about what happened on Tuesday night, but that he was right to be warning about that. So we'll talk to him about the Democratic autopsy. And we've got Congressman Byron Donalds to talk about what does happen. Listen, if Republicans take the White House, Senate, and House, there's going to be pressure on to get things done with the border, with these tax cuts, with all kinds of policies. What's the plan?
Well, that's great. We have Joe Manchin. We have Tom Cotton. And we're going to have Douglas Murray. Mm-hmm. I don't think I'm able to keep up with any of these intellects.
I think you have Tommy Lahren. Who else have you got? I heard you talking about it this morning. I know you got a great lineup.
Good memory. Yes, and Tommy Lahren's going to break down the media. You know, the hardest thing is going to be knocking it down to four. Because I can't get enough of this, in that I thought the late-night shows would make a few jokes. Well, I had that wrong. I mean, Stephen Colbert literally talked to me like I'm Mr. Rogers. Mm-hmm. I know. We've had a bad day. Me too. How do you feel? It's okay.
There were people that were losing themselves emotionally, which I understand for normal people. That's going to happen. It's really hard for half of the country every 2 to 4 years.
But not if you're hosting a late-night show.
But not if you are hosting a show. I think that you have to pull it together if you're hosting a show.
One thing I do, and Eric and Pete know this, is I will often – I'll do my weeping between 9 and 9.06. So when I leave Fox and Friends, that's really the only downtime
you have in the entire day is from 9 to 9.06.
And I cry.
The breakdown's going to happen.
I cry my eyes out.
You do it then. You shake it off. You get a Red Bull, and you get back to work.
So I want you to hear the advice that Joe Rogan, the newest endorser and friend of Donald Trump, gave. And ask me and see if you think the president will take this advice. Cut 7.
We got a real chance to make real change. This is like one of the first times ever where there's a real chance to make real tangible change that's going to be for the good of everybody. He's got to unite people. He's got to not attack the left, not attack everybody. Let them all talk their but unite. Now it's time to unite everybody.
What do you think?
Yeah, and I think this is where Susie Wiles comes in, too. I think she'll have a big influence on where he goes, where he focuses his energy and his legislative policy and all those things. But I do think he has an opportunity. And remember, in 2016, when he won, it surprised a ton of people. There were all these calls, you got to prosecute Hillary Clinton and lock her up and all that kind of stuff. And he sort of demurred like, you know, that's not going to be a focus for us. I don't think that's good for the country. We got other things to do and move on. So I think he's totally capable of doing things he thinks are good for this country. And I do think genuinely, whether you like his policies or not, you spend some time talking to him. He is about a deep love for this country.
I can't wait to see you one-on-one with him. Have you had him one-on-one?
I have, not recently, but yeah, I have in the past.
I mean, why not? Why can't you be the first interview since the win?
I could be. Let's make it happen. We're working on it.
All right, you should do that. I'd love to see it.
I'll tell him you said so.
And Janet, great coverage. You do a great job. You always rattle, always insightful, bringing us through rough unscripted times.
I didn't cry. Mm. You know, I kept my emotions in check.
I did see you in the green room.
You know what I did get fueled by on election night?
Which
Magnolia
was?
Bakery. There's that one right by Fox in New York, and they're banana pudding. I decided to eat that for dinner, which maybe wasn't my best choice, but it seemed like a fun election night thing to do.
Well, that was good. I didn't know anything was open late at night.
Well, I got that before we got started. You know, because we did broadcast coverage 7 p.m. to 3 a.m., and I thought, it's going to be a night for sugar. I don't do caffeine. So it was a sugar night.
Well, you're caffeine free?
I'm caffeine free.
Oh, my goodness. Really?
Listen, I know you have 18 jobs. And so listen, you're up at 2 o'clock in the morning. So I don't expect you to be caffeine free.
Wow, that is such discipline. What do you do wrong?
You know, there's a lot of swearing. You've heard that.
That is not true.
I've got my own bad habits. There's a lot of online shopping. That's probably
a problem. Are you Catholic?
I'm not. I'm an evangelical Christian, and so I know that I'm a sinner saved by grace. So I'm thankful for forgiveness every day where I do mess
because,
it up.
Because I was going to say, Kat, do you do confession where you are?
Well, the way we evangelicals do it is we just pray all the time. And so we're confessing all the time, and I find this: the closer I confess to the sin I've committed, then I just get it fixed and move on.
Right. We do this. The Catholic Church does confession. I would love yours televised.
You know what? I don't know that I'd be comfortable with that. but I do think, gosh, there's something about having accountability and going to someone and having that in your life, whatever denomination you are. I think it's good to have, you know, people can help you walk through stuff. So, I do a lot of confessing. And I find the sooner the better. That's how I handle it.
All right. I don't know how we got into this.
There's a chocolate problem also that I have.
Okay, good. Hey, that's not a sin, though.
No, and everything in moderation, right?
Right. I'm pretty sure. Let me read the Bible one more time and find
not
out if chocolate
that's
is
not something you want to do in moderation.
It's definitely not a
I'm
commandment.
Saying, no. But, you know, keeping your body clean, trying to live a good life. I mean, look at you. You're aging in reverse, and you work 20 hours a day. So I know you're doing something right.
I have caffeine.
And dogs.
I'd rather you find out from me than somebody else.
I like your doggies, too.
Yes. Shannon Bream, we're going to watch
Fox
News Sunday.
Okay. Saturday first.
Okay,
bye.
Great. Bye. Back in a moment.
Educating, entertaining, enlightening. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, I'll get to the phone in just a second. I just want to announce, you know, Monday's Veterans Day. If you don't worry about it, but take note. You have a way to help. You can join us by making a donation and wearing camo on Veterans Day. Post your camo on your on social media with #honor-us-vets. To donate and learn more information on how you can help U.S. vets and veteran homelessness, go to Fox/U.S. vets. So go to Fox/U.S. vets. So that's go.fox/U.S. vets. So help out. Don't forget Veterans Day. If you listen to this show, you know it matters. Mary Jane, you're in Vernon, Texas. Mary Jane.
Hello, Brian. I just love your show.
Thank you.
And I'll tell you, I'm happy because it's raining here. It's been drought, and I'm also just over the top with Trump being elected in the way he was. I think I'm going to get to go down on my blood pressure medicine.
So Mary Jane, that's good news. Mary Jane, it looks like Texas likes him more now. How does it
Texas? Yes.
This New York billionaire is liked by Texas. Why?
Just because he makes sense. I mean, you've got so many people that are just the regular common man. We're out here, we're working, he just makes sense to us.
I agree, to me
we
too.
We don't really relate to with billionaire. I mean, not that way, but you know, we don't, all of these celebrities, we can't relate to that.
I know. In fact, it's a turnoff, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm just watching to see which one leaves first.
Yeah, we'll see. I think Rob Reiner can't be happy here now. I just can't believe. I mean, they're weeping. They're actually crying. Scott, you're in the Villages. Hey, Scott.
Yeah, hey, Brian. So Joe Rogan waited until the day before the election to endorse Trump. And, so 80 million people had already voted before he even endorsed him. Elon Musk took over Twitter, or X, if you will, 2.5 years ago, opened up the X files, has over 200 million followers. So every time he would put something out there, 200 million people, probably mostly in the United States, saw that. So I think his impact is by far much greater than Joe Rogan. But
no argument.
Joe, Brian.
No argument here. And not only that, he campaigned for him, and then he got a ground game going. I called over to the campaign. I said, I know super PACs are kind of running your ground game. Who's the biggest contributor? And they said Elon Musk, and then it was Charlie Kirk's group. So he jumped in, and then he set up a ground game. I've never seen anything like it. I mean, he's number one in space, number one in brain chips. He's building a tunnel company, number one in electric cars, number one with Starlink in the sky. Is this a joke? It's like a comic book success. And now he helped the guy become president. And he's going to be doing a lot to make our government more efficient. I'm optimistic. Are you?
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I don't take it seriously. I mean, we've been down this road before. Hamas's position has been pretty steady, you know, since the last hostage release last year. Their position has been hard fast that they'll only deal with complete Israeli withdrawal and cessation of all military activities. That has been their position. I'm assuming that's the direction they're heading, and this is more a fig leaf than anything else.
So they're talking about Hamas says they want an end to the fighting now that Donald Trump has won the election. What does it actually mean for the people in Israel? Is it a real overture to end the violence? Zvika Klein is the editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post, kind enough to come in studio. Zvika, great to see you.
Hey, Brian, how are you?
Hamas's latest posture since the election is?
You know, they've been kind of quiet. I mean, first of all, the IDF eliminated most of its leadership, right? So it's kind of, obviously their social media is still working, but they're not, you know, actively responding very quickly.
Are there rockets into Israel still?
From
Hamas,
and from Hezbollah and from Yemen, from Iraq, from even from Jordan. There was like a one time,
really
one time kind of thing.
How were they able to get rockets? Well, you guys, because you know you clear, but you don't hold,
right?
So you clear, and they'll just reconstitute
100%. And it's just like, you know, it's crazy. I mean, it's more than a year now of just seven, literally, you know. It's not like metaphoric, seven fronts. of nonstop attacks against Israel. It's just crazy.
But the progress you're making militarily seems to be substantial.
It is substantial, but again, it's seven fronts, and there's lots of money that has been invested for years, you know, in Hezbollah and Hamas, tunnels, drone attacks. And by the way, also drone attacks are semi-new to the warfare, so the effectiveness of you know, shooting them down is limited. But also, you know, the fact that you ask me if we're still being shot at is because of, you know, the Iron Dome and all these other amazing inventions that are shooting them down. So a lot less people are being killed, but people are also being killed. But like, we got used to this like situation where we're like, we're shooting them down, but we're still being shot at.
Yeah. So Iran promises to, they looked at what you did and with your bombing retaliation.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone's like, well, not too bad. 100 aircraft, 20 sites. And they looked around and go, well, it is bad.
Yeah.
You took out almost all their missile defense.
Well, I mean, their public reaction, first of all, was nothing happened. Then it was like, oh, it was only in certain, you know, there was a very slow release of what they say. And they still haven't really, you know, admitted to the harm that Israel has done there. But that said, you know, Israel has definitely, according to many sources, you know, harmed their air defense system. So in a sense, but, and also the entire, you know, the operation in Iran was about like 4 hours. So imagine 4 hours Israeli Air Force just doing whatever they want.
Right.
But actually being, because of, especially because of the Biden administration, being very cautious and very focused on specific targets, as opposed to probably what others in the Israeli government would have wanted.
So when the IRGC says we're going to come out and knock your teeth out, what are they talking about? They know the retaliation is almost something you guys want. Give me an opportunity to go back again. They must know that.
They're also psychologically enjoying the fact that Israelis are kind of like on alert and like waiting for this next Iranian attack and are nervous about it, or, you know, cautious about it. That said, you know, they're an extreme group of people, and I think the things that they say sometimes are kind of like this opposite psychology thing where, like, you know, they actually are afraid, but they can't, in their eyes, you know, in Middle Eastern, whatever, you want to show that you're strong. So that's their way of, you know, speaking up, showing their citizens that they're not weak.
So there's no doubt about it. They just Trump is back in office. They're still trying with the assassination. Joe Biden's been holding you guys back. He's been very critical behind the scenes and concerned about his own electoral future, being critical at home.
I will just add that, yes, but the Biden administration also did assist Israel. Like, they didn't ignore Israel. You know what I'm saying?
No one ever thought they
would ignore Israel. I mean, there's some people that would want them to not help, right? And, you know,
Kamala Harris would have been worse.
Woke Americans, right, are probably not happy about it. And she suffered from it.
Yeah, she suffered from it. Good luck with that. And what Trump did, you don't know this probably, but he went and met with the Arab leaders in Michigan. And he said, look,
I'm
for peace. We're for peace. I'm not looking to start a war. We are going to back Israel.
So I'll tell you, a lot of Israelis are a bit nervous about, you know, Trump. His track record when it comes to the Middle East and Israel is overwhelming, probably the most than any other American president has done for Israel. The question is this the same Trump, right? You know, we spoke before, you know, we were on air about the Jewish, you know, people surrounding Trump. It seemed that in 2016, there were a lot more, you know, visible Jews around him advising.
Well, you only name one person. Part.
Well, his son-in-law.
Well, no, but I'm saying he's got Susie Wiles.
He only named one person.
He hasn't
named 100%, but the campaign, right? His kids were involved, but you didn't see Jared and Ivanka, right? We did see them when he finally made his speech.
I think that they, as private citizens, they want to get back to private citizenship, young family too.
Yeah.
Took a lot of criticism. They weren't, in my opinion, they weren't used to it.
Right.
They were, I mean, pretty much they walked to the best parties with the best, most important people.
Right.
And Jared's family as well as his, you know that.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, they were persona non grata in a lot of places. And they have young kids, and they thought, you know, why am I doing this?
Right. But historically, I mean, you know, this is not a very near history, you know, close history. They did amazing things. you know, moving the American embassy to Jerusalem. No other president did it. You know, bipartisan, that was a thing in a campaign. Acknowledging the Golan Heights, the Abraham Accords is, I'm telling you, like an Israel, any Israeli or American, you'd tell that 10 years ago would be like, come on, what are you talking about?
Right.
You know, so if that continues, that will be amazing. If the Saudi deal actually will happen, you know, that's amazing. If we're able to end this war while Israel is strong, mm-hmm. that's amazing. But does he want us to continue this war? I think he kind of wants it to end, you know?
Well,
you
all do, but it's how it ends, it will actually decide when we'll start again.
100%.
So you have these hostages you want to get out. Now,
right.
If Hamas is really decimated, they'd make an offer to release all the hostages and try to put pressure on Netanyahu to act.
Right.
This is going to be so interesting to see if they're politically savvy enough to be able to work the refs.
Right. Interestingly, I just saw a report on Israeli news that an official in Qatar told the heads of Hamas in Doha that they're no longer, you know, wanted. They're no longer happy.
No longer welcome there.
Welcome.
They want Hamas out of Doha.
According to this report, it's a very initial report. I think it's interesting because there has been, you know, people have been saying, why isn't America saying to them, you know, you want to be our ally, get him out.
Well, there's a theory that you guys want somebody to talk to and that you need somebody to talk to in a place that's not in the middle of Gaza.
I'm 100%. So I'm actually not one of those people. I was actually in Qatar a few months ago. I was one of the first Israeli journalists to go meet with the top leadership of Qatar. And it's a complex situation. I think diplomacy in general is complicated, right? You know, are they as, you know, pro-Israel as you are, Brian? No. But they want to be Western, and they want to be acknowledged by the Western world.
They want to do business.
And they want to do business, and they want to be safe.
Right.
Right? They have tough neighbors as well. So, you know, it's interesting.
Right, because they share land with Iran.
Yeah.
And they can't just say, Iran, you know, you're the bad guys in this. That's
right.
Going to be a problem.
Right.
Because obviously Iran will go to any lengths and they don't care about the international
rule. And they don't have like an army as, you know, as strong as we do. So it's
They don't even have – do they have one?
I met the ambassador in Berlin and he was part of their Air Force. So I assume there's something, but
– Right. You know. So we have a situation where – how was that the pager story? That is one of the most amazing stories we'll ever hear about in our life.
I'm sure there'll be movies and books and whatever. I'm sure the smart people are already finishing up those books and movies.
The taking out of Haniyeh at a guest house to welcome in a new president.
In Iran.
Just
eliminating him. Nobody else.
The Grand Ayatollah.
Crazy.
The Grand Ayatollah knows he's also next. And he's
right.
Basically in hiding, pops out once in a while. And he's also sick.
Mm-hmm.
But is it true the Iranian population hates their government? Or is that too much of a broad statement?
I don't know enough. And also, I think polling is probably problematic in Iran. Interestingly, there's a small Jewish community in Iran, and they speak up whether they need to or they actually believe it against the Zionist state, you know, which is interesting.
Right. Against you guys.
Yeah.
Self-preservation.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah.
So Netanyahu right now, is his popularity going up?
So his popularity at the beginning of the war, and we spoke at the beginning of the war, was very low. It's higher than it, I think, pretty much ever was because of all these operations you mentioned, you know, the pagers and the elimination of Haniyeh,
etc. Nasrallah,
100%. That said, now, firing Yoav Gallant, the minister of defense, on the eve of the American election is a big deal. Many people went out to the streets. A lot of people are frustrated, basically replacing him by someone who has no security qualifications whatsoever. And, you know, I think also those who are more liberal, Gallant was kind of the more liberal one in the current Israeli government. So, they see this as a very dramatic moment.
There's no doubt about it. I look at, you know, the Israeli economy's got to function in order to finance this war. So how hard has that been?
It's dramatic. Listen, I mean, you have businesses falling apart. People don't usually notice this. I could say, so I'm 41 and I live in a neighborhood where for a long time, most of my neighbors were not home. for months, half a year, on and off, in reserve service. And, like, these are people who are lawyers, work for the government, high tech, whatever, but or own little business, small businesses. And a lot of them are collapsing, and the amount of money spending on security is just overwhelming. So there's a real problem there.
So I guess so you got to get that going.
And no tourism.
Right.
No tourism, you know, it's just here and there.
So we have a situation that's going to drag on, but you get the sense that people are going to make moves before Trump comes in. What are people telling you?
So interestingly, a number of people I spoke to said, you know, there's like an 8-week period now for Israel to, I wouldn't say do whatever it wants, but Trump is going to want to, you know, Trump doesn't take any, you know, any BS from anyone. And he's going to want to kind of get to the situation where he can end a war in an effective way. So if we want to attack Iran, it may be now.
Right. And do you have the weaponry you need?
We? Of course we do. To attack Iran?
But to attack Iran? You think you do?
We were so easy. We were so... And listen, I told you, 4 hours and nothing. Like, they all came back. All the airplanes came back. Like, you know, no... There was no, you know, casualties. No one was injured. That's crazy. And this was like a very restrained attack.
So the sense is you might have a window of opportunity.
100%.
And then it was explained to me that you guys do have enough what it takes to do some serious damage on the nuclear program. Some said you didn't without our help, but our help would actually destroy it.
Right, 100%.
And wouldn't that help
the question is, would there be that help? It's, you know, it's an interesting question. I don't have an answer for that.
But
at the moment,
do you think most of the region will be for getting rid of it? After all, nobody wants Iran to have it.
Right. So here's the question: do you go all out, or do you actually go and, like, let's say, destroy their oil, and then their economy will fall apart? That's another, you know, voice.
And it's vulnerable. There's no protection for that oil.
No.
Do you think that this might not be your area of expertise, but does it affect your oil market? Respect the world oil market if Iran is offline?
100%.
Even though they're not going to capacity and there's heavy sanctions?
It already has an effect. And you know, just the fact that the Houthis in the Mediterranean or whatever, control a huge amount of sea area, prices are going up in Europe and in Israel and other places because you have to, instead of shipping, you fly it over, but that's more expensive.
Why is it so hard to neutralize the Houthi rebels? You guys hit them hard. We've hit them before.
Yeah,
UK's hit them.
But it's very kind of, I feel like it's
surgical.
Like a, yeah, here and there type thing. I mean, the question is, how many fronts can you actually win effectively?
Right. But you can't,
because they're not,
the,
it doesn't seem like they're, it doesn't seem like they're the most, you know, I would say, the biggest or the most successful terrorist group out there. But they definitely are, you know, making their rounds.
Well, but yeah, you guys did. I thought you eviscerated them, but I guess that didn't happen. Lastly, you with Hezbollah, the goal was to keep you guys at bay and stop the Iranians from to stop you from blowing up the Iranians' nuclear program. Hezbollah said, hey, we got long-range missiles. We're going to rain them on Tel Aviv. Mm-hmm. You're not going to be able to stop it.
Right.
Well, the word is, over the last few months, you've done a heck of a job in eliminating their long-range missiles, which would leave Iran totally naked with their program.
Right. But
this seems to be a very unique window of opportunity.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think there really is a window of opportunity now. The question is if what the American administration is going to do or not do. You know, they've been very clear most of these attacks saying we haven't been involved or we knew or we didn't know. Usually they say we didn't know or we were updated like a second before. It's a big question. And I don't know if Biden has the bandwidth for that at the moment.
Zvika Klein, thanks so much. Pick up the Jerusalem Post. Definitely read it online to find out the latest on what the whole world is looking at. He's over there as editor. Zvika, great to see you. Thanks so much for coming by.
Thank you.
All right, back with a few calls when we come back. Brian Kilmeade Show.
It's Brian Kilmeade. More to know. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen is the most recommended memory support brand by pharmacists.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. Thanks so much for listening. Quick note, don't forget, Saturday, 9 o'clock, amongst my great roster of guests on One Nation on Fox News, Joe Manchin, Tom Cotton, as well as Douglas Murray. So here is the other news you're not getting. Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese announced a groundbreaking proposal on Thursday to implement a social media ban for children under 16. I love it. Government cites risk to mental and physical health. The ban would start as soon as next year. Excellent. Monkey mayhem. As dozens of primates escaped South Carolina Research Center 43 in all, they believe it was just one guy's idea and the rest followed. So if you just return on your own, this does not have to be ugly. That's my message to the monkeys who might be listening. Residents are strongly advised to keep doors and windows secure closed. Next, Warner Brothers CEO David Zaslav suggested that Donald Trump's re-election could be good for media business. Quote, it's too early to tell, but it may offer an opportunity for consolidation that may be quite different. They will provide a real positive and accelerated impact on the industry. What do you think he's talking about, Eric, Pete? Does anybody know? What's going to consolidate?
Well, we know the media loves Trump. Lots of clicks, like, you know, lots of
that I would think
no
good,
what.
But why consolidate? Like, is he looking to get Warner Brothers with CNN or sell off CNN? I don't know. But, he's really taking a hatchet to that organization. Next, Roku and Amazon are the most popular brands of streaming media players purchased, according to the New Parks Association. 65% of U.S. internet households named one of these brands as their primary streaming device. What do you use? Pete, what do you use? Do you stream anything?
I usually use Amazon Fire TV.
What about you, Eric? Do you stream anything in particular?
Mostly Hulu.
Mostly Hulu?
YouTube, yeah.
I'll go on Prime, Paramount, Netflix. Fox.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. Congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.